Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into, really one of the toughest jobs in medicine, managing a critical patient. Specifically, when their whole system is collapsing into shock, our mission, not just to define shock, but really dig into the decision-making needed when you're, fighting the clock against cell death.
That decision-making piece is absolutely critical. I mean, when that patient hits the door, the goals have to be lightning fast. You need a rapid assessment, quick life-saving treatment, develop that differential diagnosis, and then fast nail down a working diagnosis to guide what you actually do. It takes really well-trained people who know how to use every single second.
And it's crucial to remember, we're not usually talking about someone who was perfectly healthy moments before. These patients often have serious underlying conditions, maybe major trauma, or they're already circling the drain in that peri-arrest phase. So the responder has to grasp the failure mechanism and juggle all those other factors.
Right. So where do you start? How do you build that ability to make good calls under, intense pressure? It really comes down to experience. Yeah. Clinical time, formal training, those long internships, and then getting certified and licensed. It's a craft you have to hone.
And experience builds that that intuition we often talk about. But let's define it carefully. It's not just a vague gut feeling. It's rapid pattern recognition. Seeing the pattern, matching into past cases. It lets a skilled clinician sort of up-triage someone, right?
Mm-hmm.
They see the danger, even if the numbers haven't crashed yet.
Intuition is powerful, absolutely. But it's definitely a tightrope walk.
Yeah.
We have to throw in a big caution flag here about cognitive traps. Decision bias, even the sharpest people fall into them. We really hammer avoiding two big ones. First, confrontation bias. That's where you sort of only look for info that backs up your first hunch.
Yeah, you ignore stuff that doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And the second one, anchoring bias. That one seems particularly dangerous in trauma.
Oh, absolutely. Anchoring is when you let one early piece of info like, the patient was talking fine 5 minutes ago, or that first BP reading wasn't that bad, warp your view of what's happening now. You get anchored to that initial point and you miss the signs that things are getting worse fast. Overconfidence there can, lead straight to misjudgment.
Okay, so you're moving fast, using that pattern recognition, trying not to get anchored or biased.
Yeah.
How do you communicate clearly, especially in a chaotic scene? We need some structure. And that's where Carl Weick's process comes in. It gives you that clarity. It's a simple five-step thing. One, here's what I think we're facing.
Two, here's what I think we need to do.
Three, here's why I think that.
Four, here's what we need to watch closely.
And number five, critically, does anyone else see anything different? Any other concerns? It forces you to be concise, makes you accountable,
yeah.
And it's a built-in check against those biases.
So, okay, you've got the mindset structured. Now the target. The actual physical failure. Shock. Fundamentally, shock is just the collapse of the cardiovascular system. It fails. And that means not enough perfusion to organs and tissues. If you don't fix it, it leads to death. Simple as that.
Insufficient perfusion. So the cells aren't getting what they need. What specifically is required for adequate perfusion? What keeps the lights on?
You need blood circulating properly to meet all the cells' needs. So that means four things happening at once. One, a working cardiovascular system, heart vessels, the works. Two, good gas exchange, oxygen in, CO2 out. Three, getting enough nutrients delivered. And four, clearing out the waste products effectively.
The body's got this amazing balancing act to keep pressure and flow right. How does that actually work, the mechanics of it?
It really boils down to cardiac output CO. That's the volume of blood the heart pumps each minute. Obviously, the heart needs to be strong enough and have good blood supply itself. But overall, blood pressure, BP, is mainly controlled by three things. That cardiac output, systemic vascular resistance, or SVR, basically how tight the pipes are, and overall blood volume. The physics are straightforward. Cardiac output equals heart rate times stroke volume. And blood pressure equals cardiac output times that systemic vascular resistance.
Ah, okay. That makes it clear why people visualize it with the perfusion triangle.
Exactly. The triangle's three points are the heart, the pump, the blood vessels, the pipes or container, and the blood and body fluids, the fluid volume itself. Shock happens when at least one side of that triangle isn't holding up its end.
And if that failure goes on, the breakdown starts small, right, at the cellular level. What's that tipping point where a cell kind of gives up on normal energy production?
Right. So shock causes ischemia, not enough blood flow to the cells. The body tries to compensate first, shunting blood to the brain and heart away from less vital areas. But if that poor perfusion keeps going, the cells run out of oxygen and they're forced to switch to anaerobic metabolism. That's the critical switch.
Anaerobic metabolism sounds like a backup plan, but not a good one long term. More like taking out a high interest loan.
That's a great analogy. The body can only do it for a very short time. It quickly leads to systemic acidosis, uses up energy stores fast, and you get a buildup of pyruvic acid. This lack of energy not making enough ATP causes the sodium-potassium pump in the cell wall to fail. That's huge. When that pump breaks, sodium floods into the cell, water follows, the cell swells up, and that whole mechanism is really the gateway to organ failure down the line.
Wow, so the responder's whole mission is to stop that cascade before the debt becomes, well, irreversible.
Precisely. And that failure unfolds in stages. We talk about compensated shock and decompensated shock, sometimes mapped to four grades or classes of hemorrhage. The key is spotting it early and jumping on treatment immediately.
How do you tell the difference between those two phases out in the field, clinically?
Okay, in compensated shock, think classes A and 2, hemorrhage the body is still managing to compensate. Blood pressure might actually look okay, which can fool you. At this stage, often the patient's mental status, their level of responsiveness, is your best clue about how well tissues are really being perfused. Now, when you slide into decompensated shock classes 3 and 4, you've lost maybe more than 30% of blood volume. The body's tricks aren't working anymore. If you see the blood pressure actually drop, that means shock is already pretty far along.
Which brings us right to that concept everyone hears about, the golden hour.
Yeah, we talk about the golden hour because the data shows if major organs don't get enough blood for more than roughly 60 minutes, you start getting significant complications: heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, the gut. They suffer damage that can become permanent. You absolutely have to beat that clock.
Okay, so let's talk action. Speed's everything. What's that immediate structured assessment sequence for a critical patient?
The primary survey has to be fast. Really fast. Start with your general impression, then mental status, usually AVPU, alert, response to voice, response to pain, or unresponsive, then airway and breathing. Now, here's a key point. If you see massive external bleeding, life-threatening hemorrhage, you immediately switch gears to XABCDE.
XCCDE, right? That X comes first. Stop the catastrophic bleeding before you even deal with the airway.
Correct. If there's no massive bleeding, then you follow the standard ABCs. Then circulation, check a pulse. Radial if they're conscious, carotid if unconscious. And critically important, check the skin. CTC color, temperature, condition, is it pale, cool, clammy? And finally, right then, the transport decision. If that patient is hypotensive, showing signs of shock, they need transport now. Scene time should be ideally 10 minutes or less.
Got it. Decision made, load and go. What are the absolute first priorities for care during that initial phase?
Airway and breathing support always comes first. High flow oxygen, maybe help them ventilate if needed. At the same time, control any external bleeding you found. Keep them warm. Hypothermia makes everything worse. And start thinking about IV access for volume expansion.
Okay, IV fluids. You mentioned volume expanders, crystalloids like normal saline or lactated ringers. This is where there's a trade-off, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. It's a calculated risk every time. Giving fluids is essential for many shock patients, especially hypovolemic ones, to boost volume quickly. But, and this is a big but, those crystalloid solutions don't carry oxygen. They also thin the blood, making it less viscous, and they can actually dilute the clotting factors the body needs to start bleeding. Knowing you might be hindering clotting while you're trying to restore volume, that definitely forces you to weigh the immediate need against potential downstream problems.
Okay, so we've covered the how it fails. Now let's look at the why. Identifying the cause is key for treatment. We usually group shock into three main types: cardiogenic, distributive, and hypovolemic. And sometimes obstructive is listed as a fourth.
Right. Let's start with cardiogenic shock. This is straightforward pump failure. The heart muscle itself is too weak to pump effectively. Often it's because of a big heart attack, an AMI. The mechanism is just lack of pumping strength.
And since it's the heart muscle itself, what can you realistically do in the field?
Field management is often quite limited, unfortunately. Secure the airway, give oxygen, try to get a 12-lead ECG if possible, maybe give a small, careful fluid bolus, but the main thing is rapid transport. Spending a lot of time on scene trying to stabilize them usually doesn't help. They need specialized cardiac care fast.
Okay, next category, obstructive shock. This one's different. It's not the pump, not the fluid volume, but something physically blocking blood flow.
Exactly. Think of a physical obstruction in or around the heart or the major vessels. Classic examples are tension pneumothorax, where trapped air collapses a lung and squeezes the heart, or cardiac tamponade. Tamponade is when blood leaks into the sac around the heart, the pericardium, and literally compresses it so it can't fill properly. A telltale sign can be muffled heart sounds, and seeing the systolic and diastolic pressures get really close together.
Then the third big one, Distributive shock. Here, the problem isn't the pump or the volume, it's the pipes, right? The blood vessels. They dilate massively.
That's it. Widespread vasodilation. The vascular container gets huge, so the normal amount of blood can't fill it properly, and it just pools. Blood pressure plummets because the systemic vascular resistance, SVR, drops like a rock. First subtype here is septic shock. This is from a massive body-wide infection, often bacterial. Now, technically, they become hypovolemic relative to this massively expanded vascular space, but here's the tricky part. They often present with warm or even hot skin because of all that vasodilation near the surface. Unlike the cold, clammy skin you usually see, they need rapid transport for really complex hospital care, antibiotics, fluids, maybe vasopressors.
Okay, also underdistributive is neurogenic shock. That's related to spinal cord injuries.
Correct. If you injure the spinal cord high enough, you can knock out the sympathetic nervous system's control over blood vessel tone. The brain basically loses the signal telling the vessels to stay constricted, so they relax completely. Massive vasodilation again, blood pools. Key management is careful immobilization to protect the spine, fluids, and sometimes drugs called vasopressors to artificially squeeze those vessels.
And the last type of distributive, anaphylactic shock. The severe allergic reaction.
Yeah, anaphylaxis is a violent systemic reaction. It causes two problems at once. Massive widespread vasodilation, and it makes capillaries leaky, so fluid shifts out of the blood vessels into the tissues. So you get the distributive problem, huge container, and you also rapidly become hypovolemic, not enough fluid left in the pipes. Management involves getting rid of whatever caused the reaction, aggressive airway and breathing support, and giving epinephrine. Epinephrine is key because it constricts blood vessels and opens up the airways, plus other supportive care.
And that leaves the last major category, which might be the most intuitive one, hypovolemic shock, simply not enough volume.
Exactly, not enough blood or fluid in the system. This can be hemorrhagic from bleeding or non-hemorrhagic, like severe dehydration from vomiting, diarrhea, or heat stroke. And this brings us back to those early signs we talked about.
Right, the restlessness and anxiety.
Yeah. Long before the DP tanks, you might just see that anxiety, that restlessness. Then maybe poor skin turgor pinched the skin and it stays tented and that weak, rapid pulse. When you see those signs, especially together, you should be thinking volume loss. The goal here is crystal clear. Save the vital organs, brain, lungs, kidneys, by replacing that lost volume fast.
Wow. Okay, so we've gone from the tiny scale, that ATP debt, the sodium pump failing inside a cell, all the way up to the big picture, the assessment frameworks, the different types of shock. That is a tremendous amount of information to process under pressure.
And that really is the core challenge for the critical care provider, isn't it? You have to juggle the complex physiology, remembering the perfusion triangle, maybe even thinking about formulas like COHRXSV while at the same time staying mentally disciplined. You have to consciously fight those cognitive traps, like getting anchored on an early vital sign, especially when the patient's condition is changing literally minute by minute or even faster.
It's that blend of deep knowledge and disciplined thinking. Which leads us to our final thought for you, the listener. Consider this. We know that in irreversible shock, even the most aggressive treatment later on can't fix the damage already done to vital organs. So how does really understanding those precise stages, the cellular failure, the systemic decompensation, change how you view those first critical minutes? And if you were designing the perfect training program, how would you prioritize teaching not just the what and how, but that structured decision-making needed to truly beat the clock of that golden hour?